Hello, and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Rigby Bendel. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah, Rigby, I'm glad we could finally connect. You know, I remember being on a couple of Discords with you when we were working on projects, and I've wanted to interview you for a while, but you seem to be a pretty busy person.
I mean, I keep busy. It's really funny because I haven't thought of myself as busy for that long. I still, for a while, was like, I'm new to this, but turns out I've been doing this for a couple of years now, and I've gotten a lot on my plate as a result.
Well, Rigby is the regional coordinator for Paizo Organized Play in Central Virginia, and as a freelancer, has written several Pathfinder and Starfinder scenarios, as well as has contributed to Paizo hardcovers in both these gaming systems. Now, Rigby, can you talk a little bit more about what you do for Organized Play and maybe how you got involved in the first place?
Yeah, so I am the venture captain for Richmond and the surrounding Central Virginia region. We have a lot of smaller cities and locales that I help coordinate as well if it doesn't have multiple locations there. So I work with some people out in Staunton. I've worked with people in Fredericksburg. So if you're familiar with Virginia, it's kind of a broad area. I first got started with Organized Play in 2013. My sister actually got me into it. She took me to my first Pathfinder Society game, and you know, I had a couple like months where I wasn't super into it, but I was doing it because like we were living together at the time. I just started grad school. I didn't have a ton of other things going on, and then I kind of stuck with it. And eventually got more involved as a GM, really came to love running games more than playing them. And then I started organizing store events, and then started organizing like the greater community, and then ended up in the regional, like I say regional because I work with people all throughout Central Virginia instead of just like one city. Got involved with organizing the organizers.
Do you organize any conventions down there as well?
Yeah, so I organize a couple conventions, particularly the Pathfinder and Starfinder Society gaming rooms. I was in the process of organizing MarsCon, which is in Williamsburg.
Right,
it was
right.
Supposed to happen in January, but it just got pushed back to mid-March due to COVID. I've also worked with RavenCon before, and I've done some work with like some other smaller local conventions as well.
Now, you just mentioned what happened with MarsCon. What is COVID and the pandemic overall? How's that have affected organized play in your area?
So it's been a huge curveball for almost everything. We were able to do online games as a community for a couple years, and it's weird to think about COVID in years now, but that's where we're at. Like, I have a lot of experience with a lot of Roll20 games. I've been playing on Roll20 for a while. So when the pandemic hit, I was like, okay, we can immediately like pivot to have some games online and figure that out. And when we went through a variety of schedule changes, you know, at first we were just replicating our original in-person store event. So it'd be like every Monday night we would do the same games that we were planning to do at one store. And then every Friday night would be another store. Though as time went on, there became just like a lot of fatigue, both with online gaming and I think like bigger community relationships in general. I think that people went through a period where they had less patience with each other, and it just wasn't making sense. So we're not doing online games at the moment. We took a step back from that, and we were starting to move back towards having in-person games, which was capturing a completely different like group of people and players. Like maybe one or two people were both playing online and in-person games. But even those have now like started to cut back. It's been kind of disappointing to have to face so many like ups and downs in terms of setbacks and like having to make some really hard decisions based off of what resources people have, how much people want to engage. So I'm hoping that we'll make it through the next couple months to the other side of this current surge and be able to really focus on in-person games again.
You know, kind of as an aside there, I know you're also an academic down there, which I am up here in Seattle. What's your school doing in terms of opening up here after the holiday break?
Oh boy. Okay. So it seems like they're just putting off making a decision right now. that everybody's waiting for something to change, and classes start in a week. So we haven't gotten the official word from our provost office what we're going to be doing. But I'm anticipating that there's going to be some sort of delay or online start to the semester because the numbers are so high. My school also has a medical campus, so has a team of like in-house epidemiologists that they've been working with. They've already announced everybody needs to not only be vaccinated, but also have a COVID booster before February 1st. I don't know how it's going to break, but I'm assuming that there's going to be some sort of change before we actually start class.
Our school, we started on Monday and my first class was Tuesday, and this week was online, but next week is supposed to be in person. And it's like, I've already had three of my students tell me they can't make it because they've tested positive for COVID. And I'm sure I'm going to have a lot of students exposed. So I don't know. They're trying really hard to go face to face. I think it's going to slide back into online again. That's my sense.
Yeah, I think that we're a little bit lucky in that we were already starting after Martin Luther King Day to begin with.
Oh, right, right.
So we have a little bit more lead time in terms of decision-making. But I think a big question is just how quickly is this going to peak? And everybody, like a lot of the data is saying we're looking at a peak in like, you know, February-ish. But yeah, I know that a lot of people really value the face-to-face experience, but I just don't see how you can do that safely at like this specific moment in time. But I'm not the person making those big picture decisions, and I'm really glad that I do not have to.
All right, so Rigby, you've written for both Pathfinder Second Edition and Starfinder and done several scenarios for each of those. Has your role in organized play helped you in both kind of getting tapped for those and how you develop those scenarios?
So I would not be freelancing if it wasn't for organized play. In a lot of ways, it totally makes sense for me to have pivoted to game design and writing for Paizo professionally, because I have a background in creative writing already. My partner is also involved in gaming. He is a 3D modeler and game artist.
Cool.
And I spent a lot of time, like, not just playing Paizo systems, but I play a ton of other systems. Totally makes a ton of sense that I would end up doing it. But I never really thought of it as something that I could do until I was at Gen Con in 2017, I would have to say.
Yeah, it's so long ago. It's hard to, the dates are just a jumble now.
And Thurston Hillman was at, we were doing the like post PFS special, everybody go get dinner together, get some drinks, thing. And Thirsty was talking about how he didn't understand why people said it was hard to get a diverse writing team because he like looked at the group of people he was with and he was like, you know, here's a set of diverse writers, like none of you, like most of you haven't been published, but if you want to write for Paizo, like raise your hand. And so I got Thirsty's business card there, followed up with him, and then worked on my first Starfinder Society quest about six months afterwards. So for me, not only was organized play the way in which that, like, I learned a lot about, like, gaming, because I just played and GM'd a lot of games and, like, got that very, like, experience-based knowledge and understanding, but it was also the way in which, like, I built up that initial network that got me my first contact that then led me to get another contact, and then it snowballed from there.
So basically that the connection you made at Gen Con with Thirsty was kind of the start of the snowball then.
Yeah, and it wasn't just even the, like, connection of, like, oh, I have an industry contact who says that I should do it. It was the idea of, like, wait, there's nothing that I have to do. There's no, like, permission slip that I have to get in order to do this work. I can just start doing it.
And had you been doing any similar writing prior to that?
I mean, so before I started doing game design and writing, I was a poet. So most of my work prior to that was either academic, sociological writing, or it was poetry. It was like the first time where I was like, oh, I could write games. There's nothing that's keeping me from being able to do this. I actually have a very, like, unique skill set that would make me good at this.
Well, and you have a very interesting master's degree too. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that okay?
Yeah, no, I'm more than happy. So my master's degree is in sociology, and I also have a post-baccalaureate certificate in gender, sexuality, and women's studies, which is basically the equivalent of half a master's degree. And so my master's thesis was actually looking at the way in which white masculinity is replicated in gaming spaces, because I was both bringing in some critical whiteness studies and also talking about masculinity studies in the combination, because one of the things that I had really seen a lot of anecdotally in gaming spaces is that it allowed certain types of white men access to masculinity and, like, feelings of being appropriately masculine that they didn't have in other spaces. And, like, a lot of this comes down into, like, the ways in which, like, we learn how to be, like, the right gender, or, like, the ways in which, like, we learn what, like, behaviors are appropriate. So my thesis is on how people were use gaming to, like, access these, like, connections to, like, the social norms and standards that they're expected to live up to when they might not have necessarily been able to access it in different ways.
No, that's really interesting. You know, I interviewed Rob Pontius a couple weeks ago, and he mentioned a game that he plays quite a bit called Monster Hearts, which basically is a game that allows you to explore a lot of different aspects of yourself, which seems to be related to the type of thing that you were studying. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all.
Yeah, I actually just wrapped up a Monster Hearts campaign. So I'm really familiar with it. And I do think that there's definitely a segment of, like, tabletop gaming in general that is interested in talking about these like big topics through games in a lot of like really fascinating ways. I think Monster Heart's a good one. Really anything by Avery Adler is good because she also wrote the Dream Askew the Dream Askew system and The Quiet Year, all of which sort of like rethink like community and connection in a way that like talks always explicitly about like gender, sexuality, outcast, and how to fit in. So definitely a system that's close to my heart there.
And do you use any of the work that you've done from your thesis in your teaching? I'm just kind of curious.
So I teach off and on. Most of my roles is administrative, but it's definitely something that has come up a lot when I work with students. When I teach, I normally am teaching first year students, like a general introduction to the university for LGBTQIA specific students.
And
we ended up talking in my classes last semester. There were students who were talking about like community conflict through the lens of like disagreements and arguments that they were having with their D&D groups. So it became very applicable very quickly. Yeah. I think it's also super applicable when you think about like how tabletop spaces on social media really like coalesce around a particular like point of like conversation. I think of like the ways in which like we end up in cyclical like arguments on Twitter or TikTok around like, you know, hot button issues. And like sociologically, what are those conversations giving us in terms of like community building and connection? But also how the platforms that we're interacting with through social media are either encouraging or just discouraging certain types of connection with each other.
Well, and I think kind of along those ways for younger players, younger people, as they're kind of developing their idea of self, these same platforms are showing them what certain groups consider norms or not the norm, and that may or may not be problematic as well.
Exactly. And it's one of those things where I think I'm not like a pro social media person, but I'm also definitely not an anti-social media person. Like I come down very neutrally on it because from like a sociological perspective, we've had a lot of similar like in-group, out-group dynamics, normative processes, all of that for ages. It's just the like where it's happening is changing. And it's also the type of communities you can build and the type of connections you have with people are changing as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. My research is in social cognition. So, you know, it kind of blends sociology and kind of normative cognition of self and stuff like that. So
yeah, it's something that like it touches on, but is like, oh, that's like out of my area of expertise. Yeah. It's always interesting to talk to people with like who are touching on the type of work that you do, but from a different disciplinary framework.
Very cool. Very cool. So, you know, it seems like you had, you found a way to get into the industry, both through organized play and for freelancing. What advice do you have for people that are new that would like to be involved in organizing stuff for Paizo, so Paizo Organized Play, and for doing freelancing for Paizo or third-party publishers that, you know, work in the same systems?
Yeah, so my recommendation in general is to just start doing the stuff that you want to do professionally. Whether that is getting involved with community because you want to do community organization, or whether that is starting to do the work that you want to do, like to be published in. I think talking with some other freelancers as well, there's some people who really come away with this feeling that the only way that they can do the work that they want to do is when they have a contract for a specific assignment, they're getting paid for it. But there's ways in which you can start preparing yourself by just doing the work that you want to do. Like I always have projects that I'm working on that are not necessarily for publication, but they're just for myself, just for me to think through interesting design concepts, just to have fun, in part because I think that if you enjoy what you're doing, you should be doing it. The other thing is that if people want to get involved with organizing, is that there's always a need for more organizers if you want to do that. And to come in with a vision of what you want to build and who you like, what you want your community to look like, and to make your decisions based off of that. So my community, I've done a lot of really intentional community building around like inclusion and diversity and making sure that our tables are safe places for people to play at, that we are prioritizing like marginalized people and their experiences when I am doing important decision-making processes, like even things like when should we schedule games, like making sure that we're offering, you know, events that like meet people's actual schedules instead of just, you know, easy preferences.
Right. Yeah. I that's awesome. You know, I have gone to a lot of the major conventions in person, and I got to tell you, one of the things that has really struck me is even if they're trying to be inclusive, they're a lot of the tables, a lot of the big conventions aren't terribly diverse. And my local group here is in the Seattle area is pretty inclusive, pretty diverse. So I like that as a person of color. I appreciate that quite a bit. But man, you know, when I went to Gen Con, when I went to Origins, when I went to SkullCon, I just didn't see a lot of folks like myself. And I'm hoping that's going to change here over time. What's your sense of that, both from what where you've gone and also what you see happening, you know, at your level and how that might be expanding?
Yeah, so I think that part of it is I really do hope that we see some change in general about what's accessible to people. As a non-binary person myself, like, I do the thing where I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to this convention. I'm going to go play a game. Let's see if I'm going to get misgendered the entire game, because that has happened. So part of what I wanted to be like really purposeful about when I think about organizing conventions or even nights is building in ways that people can feel safe when playing the game. And some of this was like around like, we did like an LGBTQIA specific night for a while. I've always had the door open for, you know, community centers have been a place that I've really tried to reach out with. So that way people are not having to go into spaces where they feel it's potentially hostile. Like the traditional friendly local gaming store is only friendly to a certain population of people. So if you're trying to expand like the range of people who are at your events, you really need to be thinking about that as well. Like, where am I recruiting from? Where am I going to? And I think that in Virginia, it's one of those things where when I talk to my local organizers, it's like Richmond, Virginia is around 50% Black. So if we aren't having Black players regularly at the table because of where we are doing something wrong. So it's making sure that we're reaching like people who would be interested in playing where they are. And this is why I really do like support things like I said earlier, like LGBTQIA specific night and other events that are run by community members for other community members, because it lets people know like from the get-go that of course they're going to be safe and included in this particular space, and then can hopefully create like people who have relationships and trust where they're like, we're going to go try out this convention together, and if something goes wrong, at least like I've got my friend here who's also going to be in it with me, where people don't feel like they have to constantly be in that like ambassador role of like, I am the non-binary person for my local Pathfinder Society place. Like, it kind of sucks when people end up feeling like they have to be in that role.
Yeah, it uses a lot of additional energy that you could otherwise use to have fun, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. So what's next for Rigby? What are the cool things that you're working on that you can actually talk about today?
Oh, okay. So I'm always operating so far in the future that I actually have to think back. So Galactic Magic comes out this month, and
I'm excited.
That is my first hardcover book that I ever worked on. So
neat.
It'll be nice to see my actual physical Galactic Magic appear and be able to point to people that I don't think I can talk about specifically what I worked on, but if
follow me
on Twitter at Sloth Scout, once Street Date hits, I will definitely be talking about exactly what I worked on there. Some of my thoughts about how I got to certain things, like and my experience there. I really am going to do like a full breakdown of, you know, retrospective after sitting on this for a while. Here's what I think about what I did now.
That is an awesome idea. I'm just thinking, so Galactic Magic is one, it's not my first hardcover. It's the one I had the most writing I did for. And I put a lot of thought into some cool stuff there. And I'm thinking, you know what? I ought to do a podcast where I break all the stuff down. You know, what I did, there's a couple of things I think didn't make it in there too. So talk about maybe why they didn't make it in there and what I might do with that. No, that's an awesome idea. And can you go ahead and repeat your, what type of stream or a blog?
It is my Twitter. So
Twitter, okay.
On the good old Hellbird site.
Yeah.
It is Sloth Scout.
Okay.
But like a Girl Scout, but a sloth.
Yes. Yes. And a very slow scout then.
And I also worked on Dark Archive, and that's been announced that I work on that too. That book is going to be amazing. I'm so excited for it. The people I got to work with, like the team, the content, the structure. That book, I am incredibly excited for, not just from a writer's perspective, but also from like a player and a GM's perspective. I can't wait to go through that book. And then I have a Pathfinder Society scenario coming out next month.
Wow, cool.
Season 3, scenario number 11. It is No Time for Treason.
Yes, I'm signed up to play that.
Yay. So. Well, it takes place in Opara, so enjoy be ready for some nice like old school Tal'Dorei plot lines. I'm very excited for that.
Yeah, you know, you seem like you've done quite a bit equally in Starfinder and Pathfinder, and I see people that have done a lot of work do that, but as a relatively new person doing that, how did you swing it, you know?
Well, I was just kind of hungry for every opportunity I could get the chance for. So for a while, I was like keeping very close tabs on the changes within the organized play developers and then holding on to those relationships as people changed positions. So,
for example,
I started, my first scenario was assigned by Thirsty. My first quest was assigned by Thirsty. Then I managed to get a second one about a scenario about a year later.
Right.
For Starfinder as well. Then James Case became the organized play developer for like a 2-month period, and I was able to get my first Pathfinder Society scenario there, which is Seven Secrets of Dakalane Academy. And then I managed to maintain a really good, strong relationship with James Case. We work really well together, which is how I was then able to get on Dark Archive, because he was working on Dark Archive, and then was able to build relationship with other devs through referrals. Like how I managed to get on Starfinder books is that Thirsty, I recommended me to John Compton. So then I was able to get on Galactic Magic. And it was just one of those things that for my first 2 years of working on freelance Paizo projects, I was very intentionally building my relationships with devs and also really taking every opportunity I could get and treating every opportunity like this is my tryout, this is my moment to prove that I can do this. And at this point in time, I get more work than I can take on, like more offers for work than I can take on. I've had to turn down quite a bit recently, but it's also nice because I think that working in both systems makes me a better designer, because I'm thinking through problems that might be showing up in second edition Pathfinder and also in Starfinder, and thinking about what are like how would I approach these problems from two different system point of views.
Excellent. That's something I'm pretty much been mostly a Starfinder person, and that's where most of my writing's been. I've done a little bit with Pathfinder. I'm hoping to get more involved on the Pathfinder side, and I haven't tried to cultivate professional relationships with the devs so much in that regard. You know, I just contact them and stuff, but I do know them through other ways though. So, and that makes it a little uncomfortable for me then, right? To then ask somebody for something. You know, can I freelance on something when it's somebody I might be playing with or doing other things socially with? So, because I'm local here in the area.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a fine line, you know.
I know that, like, the professional relationship dynamics and tabletop in general are just kind of weird because, mm-hmm. again, like you said, I'm friends with some of the devs that I work with. Like, there are some devs that I would consider friends first and devs second.
Right, right.
But there are also people who are doing the, like, are assigning the projects that I would want to work on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So while there are some people who I mostly, you know, I've got a range of friendly to purely professional relationships, it does mm-hmm. become moments like, oh, like, this dev says that it's easiest to reach them on Discord, but, you know, I do most of my writing in the evening and it's after 5 o'clock their time. I don't want to be interrupting their
right.
their time off work, or like mm-hmm. I don't want there to be hard feelings if I do or don't get an assignment that my friend was assigning. It's complicated. I think also mm-hmm. like doing tabletop stuff professionally has also changed my relationship to my community, to like the PFS community I'm in and other like mm-hmm. general community members in ways that I'm sometimes a little like not sure how I feel about, because every time that I interact in a tabletop space, not only am I thinking of my role as like a person who, you know, should enjoy myself, but also I'm thinking of my role as am I being a good professional, am I being a good organizer, you know, as much as I know I've talked about social media before, but, you know, even in social media spaces, I'm like, is this right. something that I should be saying with all the roles that I have?
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you. I hear you. I, you know, especially, you know, my position as a professor too, because a lot of my students know that I do tabletop role-playing games, and they, when I did a lot of online gaming, a lot of them knew about that. And, you know, I had to be really careful to keep things where I didn't go overboard in one area that would come back to bite me, you know.
It's really funny because one of the departments that I work with teaches a game on tabletop game design, and I don't teach that course. I'm just involved in like making sure that the course gets scheduled and grades get put in, like that sort mm-hmm. of administrative stuff. But whenever I see that course get offered, I'm always like, I could teach that. Could teach it in a heartbeat. But it's like but it's also like, but I'm going to respect that this is not my professional space to be right. that type of expert in. I'm going to let the person mm-hmm. who teach that course and not try to overstep my boundaries yeah. there.
Yeah. Yeah. And they could be really good at it too and have lots and lots of years of experience.
Exactly. So, exactly.
You know, I'm thinking like Jason Tondro, you know, who has a PhD. He was, you know, teaching, you know, gaming related stuff and comic book related stuff. And he knows way more about both of those than I would ever figure on learning. So,
yeah, it's one of those things. So my background, while my master's is in sociology, I'm like, I also have a background in English literature. So like my focus mm-hmm. very much was on game studies, which is just right. kind of a weird space to be doing academic stuff in general. Because it's like a interdisciplinary field that you can approach from so many different points of view. So mm-hmm. I also have some of that background, but I'm not at all PhD level. Like, I keep thinking I'll go back and get my PhD, but then I also realize that I do not have the time in the day to do what I'm already doing, much less start taking more coursework and writing a dissertation.
Yeah, it's kind of a full-time commitment, really. I mean, there are some places where you can do it part-time, but to do it justice, it's a full-time thing. And
yes.
It's better to do it while you're younger. I actually started mine at 33. I was 10 years older than most people in the program.
Yes, so part of it is that there is a program that would have a specific interdisciplinary focus and I could do part-time mm-hmm. and have full funding for. So I'm in like the perfect position.
Shoot, you got to do that then. You got to do that.
But I just got to wait till I'm not always tired.
Yeah. Well, so you're saying post-pandemic then, right?
Sometime post-pandemic. I'll have to take a, you know, 6-year break on working on freelance and focus on a dissertation.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. A lot of my dissertation dealt with decision making in interactive environments. So I played a lot of video games during that. So I don't know. Anyway, so Rigby, it's been really great getting a chance to to chat with you and get to know you. Thanks again for joining us on the podcast.
Yes, thank you so much. It was great getting to talk with you, and stay safe during these times.
Oh, for sure. You too as well.